All right, good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to the most attended oral history research committee meeting of all time. We are we're fortunate today to be joined by Steve Garvey, who John will do the full introduction of, but it was tremendous of Steve to be incredibly flexible with his schedule. He's got a great engagement tonight as the Padres celebrate the 35th anniversary of the 1984 Padres. And so he was able to squeeze in Sabre during his time, and I'm really appreciative of that. And before I introduce John here, I've got one housekeeping item. We've got a pair of glasses that someone has dropped. They're in a Foster Grant case. All right, perfect. I'll come to you. So we'll get started here. John's kind enough to be our host. John McMurray is the chair of the Oral History Committee and does a great job of going out and creating his own oral record of history, along with helping us curate other archives that we can that Sabre can gain access to. So appreciative of the work, and I hope I'm doing justice to an overview of the committee for you there, John. And I'll let you take it away.
Okay, thank you, Scott. And welcome to the Oral History Committee meeting. I'm John McMurray, chair of the committee. And anyone who was a fan of baseball in the 70s and 80s knows who Steve Garvey is. Not only was he a fixture at first base for the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres, but he was in some ways the face of the sport. Steve was the 1974 National League Most Valuable Player, and he played with the Dodgers from 69 through 82. And in a move that stunned baseball, he signed with the San Diego Padres as a free agent, where he played from 83 through 87. When he left the Dodgers, the impact was felt so deeply that the Girl Scouts picketed the stadium to protest his departure. Now, Steve cut a memorable figure. Said Sports Illustrated, he stood like a statue with his head high, chin forward and Popeye arms held away from his body. One writer said that he ran as though not to wrinkle his shirt. And then there was his persona. One day, several Padres teammates reportedly threw him into the pool head first, and Goose Gossage said that when Garvey came up for air, every hair was in place. Steve Garvey has to be the only guy in the world to get tossed in a swimming pool
Vitalis.
And come out looking the same way he did going in. Now, Steve was a 10-time All-Star, a 2-time MVP of the All-Star game, a 4-time Gold Glove winner, played in 5 World Series, and still holds the National League record with 1,207 consecutive games played. And today, he has his own media company and also works as a baseball motivational speaker. So please welcome Steve Garvey.
Thank you.
Let me say a brief note about the committee's work. Our job is to chronicle stories of baseball figures on tape, whether they are players or umpires or anyone else who is connected to the game. And what I intend to do here is to create a live oral history, which lasts about 45 minutes, which we will add to our collection at oralhistory.sabre.org. And the difference with an oral history is that it's a little more granular. We go into the details of events a little bit more than you might in a traditional interview. But after it's done, we will take some audience questions, and we have some cards in the back of the room so you can write your question and submit it for the end of the program. So I'm going to start talking about Steve's most famous play as a Padre, and then I'm going to go back through his career chronologically. We'll talk about some people that he's known in the game and his opinions about some matters in baseball and try and do it all in the time allotted. So for purposes of our audio, I'm going to make a brief introduction and then we'll start. This is John McMurray of the Society for American Baseball Research Oral History Committee, and I'm speaking in San Diego, California today with Steve Garvey on June the 29th, 2019. And Steve, I wanted to ask you first about your most famous play as a Padre. Game 4 of the 1984 National League Championship Series, you were playing the Cubs, and the Padres had lost the first two games of what was then a best-of-5 series. In Game 4, the Padres were tied 5-5 in the ninth inning, and you hit a two-run home run off of Lee Smith and I wonder if you could describe that game for us.
Well, John, first of all, and to all of you here, thank you so much. It's an honor to be with you. And I know you could be doing many, many other things, but I am honored to see all of you here today. I have watched as Sabre has grown over the years, and the growth in numbers and the growth in influence and your thoughts, your interest, your compassion has had a profound effect, and I thank you for that. Back to the most exciting single game moment in my career. To go back a little bit, the Dodgers made me an offer I could refuse at the end of 82. And of course, nobody ever thought that I wouldn't be a Dodger, but they took one course and I knew I probably had one contract left. So at that time, five teams could draft you to negotiate with you. And it was San Francisco, it was the Cubs, Yankees, Houston, and the San Diego Padres. So Bob Lurie in San Francisco, wonderful gentleman, real estate guy, not a lot of liquidity, and playing a candlestick wasn't something that I thought very much about. I go to Chicago, Dallas Green to become the GM. They were in transition. They were very, very close. For 2 days, it was wine and dine, and they had a Garvey Six Cubs jersey made up, and negotiations were going great, and then all of a sudden, I think the president decided that he was being left out, and he jumped in, and it all of a sudden went backwards. So I could have swore I was going to be a Cub. That's how history can be affected. I go to New York. George Steinbrenner decides that he really was going to sign a couple of American League guys, he said, but and Jerry Capstein, who was my agent and who was a La Jolla resident, said to Mr. Steinbrenner, but think of this, Garrick DeGarvey, does it get any better than that? George goes, oh, gosh, why'd you have to say that? And he said, I'm really locked in, but I'll pump the numbers up to the New York press, which he did. Thank you very much. Went to Houston, not a great place to hit, so it was a brief visit there. Then came to San Diego, and Jerry was talking with Ballard Smith, who was the president, but his father-in-law was a man by the name of Ray Kroc, and Ray Kroc said, wait a minute, I want to talk to Stevie, just him and me. So I went to his clifftop home in La Jolla and went into his office, and we sat down, and he said, Stevie, I want you here. And I said, well, gosh, show as we wanted. Yeah, thank you, sir. He said, I got one problem. And I said, what's that? Said, I can only pay in Big Macs and French fries. And he was 84 then, you know, and you all know the evolution of his career. And I looked at him and I said, can I have him for a lifetime? He said, you can have him for a lifetime. He said, I think I can find a few bucks too, but let's get this deal done. And literally within an hour, we had a great lunch. We talked about McDonald's and success. And he said, well, I told Ballard to get a hold of Jeremy. Let's get it done by tomorrow. And it was done. So I had been part of this historic Dodger franchise, been part of their history. And to come here and then by the second year now get into the playoffs for the first time. And when you say we lost two in Chicago, we were thoroughly beaten in Chicago. We were beaten up. But the numbers dictated that instead of three games being played at Wrigley, they didn't have any lights, so it was going to be a weekend, so they flipped it around, and that's why we started in Chicago and had three games here. So coming back on the plane, the guys are standing in the aisle, gee, it's been a great year, looks like, you know, we're done. And I said, whoa, wait a minute. I said, we got it right where we want them. And the young guys, Gwynn and Kennedy guys, boy, Garb must be getting old. This is crazy. They just beat us up twice. Yeah, we're going home, but went three straight. Well, we went on the Friday night, and it was just a game where the fans got involved. And when we ran before the game, the fans stood up, and they had these crazy towels, and they were waving the towels. And every inning, they got up, and we won that game really for the fans. And then it was the great game four where and I actually been sick the night before. I didn't take batting practice. I'm laying on the table in the training room, and Dick Williams comes up. He says, well, listen, you know, we won't start you, and we'll pinch hit you. I said, Dick, I played 1,207 consecutive games, 7.5 years. I'm playing tonight. And he looked at me, and Dick was a pretty astute manager. Go get him, kid. And the first time up, I was really, equilibrium wasn't there, a little one-hopper to Dennis Eckersley, and then RBI single, RBI single, RBI single, and finally it's the bottom of the ninth. And I tell Tony Gwynn, who's leading off, I said, T, I said, just get on, and I'll try to drive the ball, as I always do, gap hitter, try to go to right. If I can get it in the gap with your speed, and he was a great base runner, let's win this thing. He said, okay, Gar. So the first pitch was against from Lee Smith. I was 0 for 6 that year. Every time I faced him was the shadows of Wrigley, and he was throwing 98. And first pitch was a fastball up a little bit. I took it, but I felt good. Adrenaline started to kick in. And then I looked at Tony, and Tony smiled at me, and Lee checked him at first base. And I figured he's not going to throw me a breaking ball. He's going to go with his best stuff. And he left it out over the plate, and I was a dead low ball hitter. But this one just looked good. And I stayed on top of it, had the backspin. It's going up, and it's that sweet spot in time where for a moment it froze. Remember the natural where the ball kind of freezes as it's going towards the lights? And I'm getting to first base, and I see the ball come down, and Henry Cotto is climbing the wall, and I'm thinking, oh, my Lord, the greatest catch in postseason history. And it lands about 5 feet, and then pandemonium. I hit first base, and I lift my fist up in the air. It's really for the fans. And by the time I got towards home plate, everybody was waiting, picked me up on my shoulders. And that was the win that evened us up and got us ready for game five. But people always ask me the greatest moment in my career, and somebody just said that. And if you play a team sport, it's winning the World Series. But for an individual game to affect the most people, that night people will tell me where they were when I hit the home run. Or, you know, we had so much faith in you guys. We learned what a winner looked like and acted like because we picked up Goose Gossage and Greg Nettles that year, and the young guys were maturing. So everybody said when that ball hit the wall, we knew you were going to win it. And the next day we go out, Rick Sutcliffe is 16-1. We're down 3-0 by the third inning and could have easily given up, as could have the fans, and the rest is history.
And people may not realize just that the Padres had never been in the postseason before that year. They had been 500 each of the two prior years, and this was a team that was in real transition. You mentioned getting Nettles and Gossage, but sure. It also had a very young core, too. Gwynn was a young player. Kevin McReynolds was a young player, and it played a lot of small ball on that team.
Oh, sure. And of course, Gary Templeton, a mature player, they picked up in a trade, I guess, with Ozzy. And Terry Kennedy had a couple extra years, but a good mature pitching staff, too. But the key was Major League Baseball wanted to open up the season the first 12 to 14 days south and not have the weather affect like it always does those opening days in New York and Chicago and Boston and wherever. So we actually played our first 12 games at home, which turned out to be a great benefit. I think we won 9 of those, got off to a good start. Maturity kicked in soon because of the older guys in our experience, younger guys who are willing to listen. And I think that was a big key for that team. And for any successful team that has a blend of mature, older players and younger players, if the young players are willing to listen and willing to make adjustments from the older players. And Dick Williams wasn't really a nonsense kind of guy. I mean, he left to his veteran players to do a lot of the one-on-one teaching and coaching and getting on guys. He was a great X's and O's guys, but it was up to Gossage, Nettles, and I to help these kids mature, and they did.
Can you describe your relationship with Tony Gwynn as a young player? I know that you mentored him a bit and advised him about how he could extend his career as he had played a long time. And I wonder if you could describe Gwynn in 84 had his first full season, his first batting title, and describe what that was like.
Well, it started really, of course, I had played against Tony, and we had talked from time to time, and I said when he used to get to first base, I was hoping he'd become a better basketball player and baseball player, but I think you're turning that around. And so my first day in spring training, and I knew that, and I was 34 at the time, that I was going to have to do extra things to buy time. That's what we do in life. As we get older, we got to work harder. There are a lot of things we have to do to catch up for our, the simplicity of youth. And I would get at spring training at 7. Most of the guys would get there 7:45, 8 o'clock. And what I used to do at Dodgertown, I would jump rope for about 25 minutes in some secluded spot. So I found a back dressing room in Yuma, Arizona at the Padre camp, and there's one light. It looked like an old boxing, you know, type of situation with a dark light and the guy's shadow boxing, you know, but I'm jumping rope. And I just kind of feel somebody's there, and I turn around, and it was Tony. He said, "Garb, what are you doing?" I said, "I'm buying time." And he laughed. "You're buying time." He said, "Am I going to have to do that?" I said, "I hope so, you know." And he laughed and he said, "Okay, that's my first lesson from the Garb right there, is you can't work too hard." And over the years, you know, and I was getting towards the end of my career, Tony really initiated the idea of the use of videotape. And we had one small machine behind home plate, and it was the 8-tracks. You know. Some of you guys probably still have the Andy Williams 8-track, you know, Mood River. I do. And Tony used to take it home, had one of the first 8-track cassettes, and watch the tapes every night. And at that time, I was taking my knowledge and career for granted a little bit. And gradually, I said, "Is it really paying off? Tell me what you're looking for." And then I started doing it. So maybe as a mentor in the beginning and growing together, and then Tony teaching me that there's a new device, there's a new skill set that you need to use to continue to buy time.
I wonder if you could take me back to when you first got interested in baseball. Your father, I know, passed his love of baseball along to you, and that you had
Big some, Joe Garvey.
Yes, and had you had some grapefruits in the backyard that you would hit as if they were baseballs.
Yep, Mom and Dad from Long Island, New York. My grandfather was a Brooklyn policeman. My mom was from Baldwin. My dad was from Glen Cove and Hempstead. And it's a longer story, but they ended up in Florida, and I was born there. And they bought their first house, and it had 12 orange and grapefruit trees on it. So, and we'll get to that first day I was a bat boy, but once I fell in love with the game, I just couldn't get enough of it. And I just loved it. And of course, hitting a baseball or an object is one of the great thrills to do in sports. So I was an only child, which is interesting because I now have 7 children, 7 grandchildren. So God's balanced out my life completely. And by the way, I have 5 girls, 5 daughters, which means I'm just here to serve. I've learned that a long time ago. And I don't carry credit cards. I only carry cash on me. Much cheaper now when the girls keep calling. But I used to pick up the small fruits in August and September and early October when they hadn't matured yet, and they were the size of maybe less than a golf ball. And I'd get a broomstick. And because I was a Yankee Dodger fan, Dad was a Brooklyn Dodger fan, Mom was a Yankee fan, she gloated a lot, you know. And I would go out, and if I hit it so far, it'd be a single, so far a double, triple, and home run. And I had the lineups of each team. And I had Robinson and Campanella and Ferrillo and Snyder and Reese and those guys. And, of course, it was Scourin and Mantle and all those guys and Barra. And it always came down to the last inning. And most of the time, the Dodgers hit a walk-off. We didn't have walk-offs back then. But I was throwing these little fruits up and hitting it with a round, little small round stick and a small round object. And I really think, even though I believe I was blessed with a certain amount of God-given talent, that really made my eye-hand coordination develop to the point where I guess arguably one of the better contact hitters during my year.
Tell me about your time as a bat boy and how the serendipity that led to you getting connected to the Dodgers.
Well, it was the spring of 1956, and of course we know it's the Grapefruit League, and Dad was driving a bus for Greyhound, and the dispatcher said, I think we did a book, my wife and I, and Ken Gernick, MLB.com, called My Bat Boy Days. And we determined it was probably March 27, 28, and because Sporting News listed the spring training games, remember? That was our Bible back then. Couldn't wait for Sporting News. Couldn't wait to catch up with the, you know, the box scores from the week before, because back east you could never get the West Coast box scores, so this was your weekly Bible. And we determined that, yes, the Dodgers had come into Tampa, and, yes, they went to St. Pete to play the Yankees. And When Dad came home that night before, he said, sat down to dinner, he said, "You want to skip school?" I said, "Wow, yeah. Gosh, Dad, I never heard you say that before, you know. What are we doing?" He says, "Well, I've got a charter tomorrow to pick up the Brooklyn Dodgers from the Tampa airport, and I think it might be a fun day for us." And I got my blue jeans out and my Bandlon shirt. How many guys remember Bandlon shirts? That's it. You're all my age. Came in 13 colors, and there was one that was a royal blue, like Dodgers, so I wore that. I had a flat top, so I got the butch wax out, you know, almost like a porcupine, right? And we picked up the bus, we drove to the tarmac, and about 8:15, Dad and I were standing in front of the bus, and in the distance there was a plane starting to bank, and it was the DC-7 prop jet. The Dodgers were the only team to have their own plane. It was the Kay O'Malley one. And all of a sudden, in that pink-gray morning, it banked and landed and came by, and it had Dodgers on the side and the baseball on the tail. And I said, "Dad, wow, look at that." Pretty heady stuff for a 7-year-old kid. And it taxied up, and there were no concourses. There was no B1 and, you know, D4. They pulled up, and they pushed the ramp up, and they opened the door, and off. First guy was Walt Alston. Later on, I would look back. Of course it was. The manager always got off first. He always sat in the front seat, and he always had a pathway in front of everybody else. But he got off, and I'm standing there, and my dad and two other gentlemen had just started the second league in Tampa, Little League in Tampa. So I had started collecting baseball cards, Topps cards, and a week later, we were going to have the first weekend of our Little League. And I was 7, but, you know, remember Little League used to be 8 to 12. I mean, 8-year-olds played with 12-year-olds. Oh, my Lord, that would never happen now. And now you got 6 and a 7 and so forth. But we didn't have enough players, so I was kind of granddaddied in at the age of 7 to play on the Cardinals, by the way. And they're here tonight already. So, but that day, you know, I had these baseball cards in my hand, and Mr. Alston came by, and then Reese came by, and Ferrillo came by, Snyder came by. And we say in the book, it was as if these players walked off my baseball cards and came to life. Because now, as a young boy, I mean, they're bigger than life. They're the world champions. They had finally beaten the Yankees in the fall of 55. So I'm standing there, and most of them had patted me on the head to see if it was really that prickly. And there's a lesson. My dad was 6'3", and I'm not, so don't pat your kids on the head too young. It'll affect the cerebellum or something like that, and stunt their growth. Better strike zone at my size. So the last two guys, and we say this in the book, were Roy Campanella and Jackie Robinson. And they were kind of lingering, and they stopped, and Jackie looks at me, says, "You play baseball, son?" And I, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Well, you practice hard. Maybe someday you're going to be a Dodger." "Yes, sir." And then Roy Campanella said those dreaded words. He looked at my dad. My dad had that great crayon uniform on. And Joe, he says, "Joe, is he a pretty good student?" "Oh, my God. Dad, please come through for me." You know, we cover for our kids sometimes, you know, because we made them, so we better cover for them. And he said, "Well, you know, he's having a little trouble reading, last in class." And he said, "He's working every night, and he's, you know, making progress." Well, you know the term now, ADHD. I've got a couple of, well, I was an ADHD kid that just called me hyper at the time. And Roy says, "Well, son, you can be as good as you possibly can on the field, but you got to be able to think. And if you do both, you'll be a Dodger." He patted me on the head. And they got on the bus, and that day, the clubhouse band, John, came out in boxer shorts and a strapped T-shirt and a little cigar, and he said to my dad, "Hey, Bussy, that's your boy?" And he said, "Yeah, tell him he's going to bat boy. We don't have anybody else." So I got a chance to bat boy for these boys this summer. But that day was the first day I really picked up a rosin bag, and I got pine tar on my hands and the smell of cut grass and spring training. And Roy Campanella had a brand new Heart of the Hide catcher's mitt, the smell of that. And back then, baseballs were made out of horsehide. And there's a difference in smell. Ran out of horses. We had to go to the cows, I guess. But there was that smell, the smells of baseball. It was my awakening that day, and I went home that night and dreamed about playing baseball.
Is there truth to the line that you said to your mother that when she heard that it was $25 for a baseball glove, you said, "Mom, look at it this way, $25 will bring $25,000 later on"?
Well, something close to that, yeah. $25,000 was a lot back at that time. You know, the top guys were probably making $25,000 then. So I was an only child. What was she going to do? You know,
so. You had the chance to join the Twins in 66, and instead you went on to Michigan State.
Yep, got drafted.
What was your thinking at the time?
Well, I love playing football, and playing football in Florida means losing 7 or 8 pounds a football game on Friday nights. But it was really good football, as you all know, and loved my baseball, and wanted to play both. And I was drafted first pick of the third round by Minnesota, and they offered $8,000, and that wasn't going to be enough. And because I would be the first in my family to get a college education. Mom and Dad were post-war, got right into jobs. But I wanted to play two sports, and at that time they were just starting the single sport philosophy. So Auburn was football, Florida State baseball, Florida football, Miami baseball, Wisconsin of all places. So finally, I was about 5 days or 10 days away from deciding. And my pitching coach had gone to Florida State. Danny Littweiler was the coach there. He had gone to Michigan State when I was a sophomore in high school. Legendary college coach. And he calls me and said, "Danny, you know, love to have you up there. They want to make you an offer." So Greyhound was on a strike. I mean, airplanes were on a strike. So we got a free ride on Greyhound because of Dad. Got up there. Danny was taking Mom and I around, showing us the campus. We got to the field house. Janice, and any Michiganers here? Any? No? Michigan or Michigan State? Security? I was happy for how far they went in the World Series this year. Yes, go green. Go green. I want you to switch with this man. Now, the farther away you get, the more you're a Big Ten guy when they play each other. Of the seven kids now, my last one, Sean Fitzpatrick's going into his junior year at Michigan State, but I have so many attorneys from Michigan. That's sinking in, right? Yeah. So, again, I decide, and Danny's there. All of a sudden, Duffy Daugherty, the great Irish football coach, the Leprechaun, came around the corner, and he says, "Danny, is this boy from Florida?" And he said, "Yeah, it is." He said, "Your name Garvey, son?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Heard you're a pretty good football player." And I said, "Well, you know, it's some success." And he said, "Well, we want you to play both here." So I found out later this was all set up, it was choreographed, that he would come and meet us. And then he said, "And I guarantee you one thing." I said, "What's that, sir?" He says, "We got 23,000 co-eds, and you're going to have a date on Friday nights, I guarantee you." And my mother looked at him. She said, "That's not our priority." But that clinched the deal because it was Michigan State, Big Ten, a chance to get away, which all of our children we've encouraged to leave the nest and get in different cultures. So that was the beginning of 2 wonderful years at Michigan State, which led to an All-American after my sophomore baseball season. And then?
Drafted in 68.
68, the great draft of 1968. Arguably the greatest.
Buckner Lopes.
Yeah, greatest draft in history. Tom Pashorek, Bobby Valentine. I think we had 8 guys at least on that draft. One draft that played over 10 years in the major leagues. But it was interesting. I had hit two-run home runs against Iowa next to the last weekend of the season. A man by the name of Guy Wellman, who is the Dodger Midwest scout, wonderful gentleman, had been trailing me around. And I think that was the final decision-making situation for him, because he put in a glowing card on me to L.A. And then when the 13th round came up, they took me. Yep.
You had a pretty quick ascent after you were drafted. You made your debut in the major leagues September 1st, 1969, near the end of the season. Tell me what you recall about your debut. I know you had a pinch-hitting role.
quickly, though, that and I think it was June 2nd or 3rd, Guy Wellman comes to our house, and Mom worked executive secretary for insurance company. Dad made sure he was going to be home, and she got home early, and she thought, well, we'd fatten him up to kill. Stuffed pork chops. We had steak. We had spaghetti. We had lemon rank pie, apple pie. You know, Guy does this 6 or 7, 8 times a year, signing draft choices. You know, he knows what's going on. So we talk about it for about an hour and 15 minutes at dinner. Guy asks us all the questions. Are you religious? Do you go to church? Where do you vacation? Stevie, a good driver? You know, all these things. We know he likes to wear nice clothes. Is that from him or you? And Mom says, fine, well, let me go do the dishes. Why don't you guys, you know, go ahead in? So Guy says, come on, Joe, Steve, make you a Dodger. So remember when you put plastic on your furniture? To preserve it. Well, we had plastic on our furniture right then, and we sat down, and Guy says, how about $10,000, guys, right off the bat? And we go, no, gosh, not much offense in L.A. Steve's got power. How about 12? Oh, gosh, Guy. Now, my dad's the greatest Greyhound bus driver in the world, but Dad doesn't do a lot of negotiating. But he had heard that first-round draft choice the year before got $25,000, right? Getting back to our $25,000. So I'm thinking, come on, Dad, we'll pay them. This is the Dodgers. We have history with the Dodgers. I know Mr. Hodges. He played catch with me. And so Dad's feeling pretty good. And the guy says, well, 18. Okay, Dad, take it. Dad's feeling pretty good about himself. He's got him from 8 to 18 right now. You know? And Dad says, you know, Guy, I just think that, you know, Steve's power is what you need. So Guy suddenly realizes, you know, well, I got to go make a call. So he's going to use your phone. Well, we had one phone. It was in the bedroom. Rotary dial. Who knows if you ever called. He comes back. He said, I talked to Mr. Campanis. This is it. He says, Mr. Campanis was able to take money from another budget. And we want to offer you $25,000. I look at Dad. He looks at me. Dad starts to answer. When, remember, Millie was drying and doing the dishes? Millie Garvey sticks her head around the corner and says, Guy. And Guy says, yeah, Millie's feeling pretty good. I'll pay Stevie $40,000 to stay at Michigan State. We're not taking it. I look at Dad. He looks at me. She's blown the whole deal. I'm going back to Michigan State, which wouldn't be bad. We're stuck to the plastic, right? We suddenly realize that. And he does. Guy would say later on, I realized that you guys weren't making a decision here. What's new? Right, ladies? So he gets up, he goes in, and we hear, now Millie. We found out he started drying the dishes. We can't hear anything. 5 minutes later, they come out arm in arm. And he says, boys, we got a deal. Okay? Yeah, Millie's convinced me that the $40,000 is really what you're worth, and we're gonna give you that. We're gonna give you your education and a new car. So that's when Dad and I learned we're just here to serve, right? But that was true story, honestly, for years. I told Jerry Capstein, if you don't do better, I'm getting Millie to do my contracts and that. But yeah, it was a mercuric rise from Ogden to Albuquerque for half a season. And then 70, at the end of Albuquerque, 69, September 1st, I come up. And I think Valentine and Buckner were with me. And that day in the seventh inning, or bottom of the eighth, down by 3 runs, Alston looks at me. He says, okay, kid, get up there for the pitcher. And I grab a helmet, and it was a double ear flap. Never saw one of those. I wouldn't know where that came from. Grabbed a bat. Didn't have any of my own. Got up, and Jack DeLora was the left-handed pitcher for the Mets. And I didn't really feel that nervous. But I just got up, and I was excited, and he threw me a little cutter inside, and I turned on it. Just missed the foul pole about 10 feet to the left. And kind of looked at it. Threw me a little tailing. This is typical lefty, right? Throw you in, little tailing fastball away. Caught it pretty good because I hit the ball down. Just missed the right field foul pole by about 5 feet. I'm thinking, it's pretty easy. If I could just keep one of these fair, yeah, I had a home run. So he wound up, and the next pitch, I'd never seen a screwball before. and I started to go after it, and it tailed away, and I swung and extended, the bat came out of my hand, went over Wayne Garrett, who was the third baseman for the Mets, head, and almost javelined in the grass in the outfield. And it's strike three. And by the way, I struck out my first at-bat, struck out my last at-bat. But in between, I'll take it, you know. So I walk back, and there's Walter Alston, on the same Walter Alston that roughed up my little butch haircut that first day. And he said, well, kid, he said, pretty auspicious start. You set a record for a bat toss fair, first of all. And he said, but you know, before it's all done, you probably get a couple thousand hits. So keep swinging. And I ended up with basically 2,600 and kept swinging. And you know, the rest is history.
Can you describe the challenges of playing third base early in your career? I know you had an injury to your shoulder from football that made that difficult. And your defensive struggles, I know, made your hold in the major leagues a little shaky at the beginning.
Shaky, yeah. I was a wild arm third baseman because I had gotten a shoulder separation making a tackle. It was later in the season, I guess the Indiana game. Before my sophomore year. So I had a good strong arm, had pitched a lot before I got to high school, but I just couldn't get on top anymore. I threw from here, and you know what happens. I mean, pitchers throw from here to throw sinkers. Well, throwing sinkers from third base, even with Wes Parker as my first baseman and all of his gold gloves, wasn't too desirable. So by the time, you know, 1973 came along, I was continuing to work hard early in the day, taking ground balls as much as possible. Went to winter ball twice to learn how to throw more from down below, which I started to get really accurate with. I could always get to every ball, always could catch it. Eventually the gold gloves proved that. But I came back for that 1973 spring, and Ron Say was there ready to go. So he was a natural third baseman, very good. So I end up in the outfield, and I'm basically the 24th man. And I start pinch hitting. And, you know, when you're 24th man, you pinch hit for the pitcher that relieved the starter who couldn't get out of the first or second inning. And then I started to get some hits and started pinch hitting in the fifth. And then finally, late inning, game-changing situations. And then on June 23rd, 1973, first game of a doubleheader against Cincinnati. And I love to tell this story because it's so much about life. Freddie Norman, little lefty, just kind of like Jack DeLore, sinker, slider, used to drive us crazy, drove Walter Alston crazy. Wait on him, wait on him, we can't wait on him, can't wait on Randy Jones, please. And I got up in the eighth, I got the second and last hit of the game for us. We lost 1-0. And I'm sitting at my little locker with my turkey sandwich. You get 30 minutes between games. And all of a sudden, I see Walt out of the corner of my eye, and he stops. He goes, you ever play first? I said, oh, sure. I played one game in Little League and one game in AAA because I had a bad hamstring, and our dugout was on the first base side. It was the closest position to get to. But I wasn't going to tell him. And he said, well, get a glove and play first tonight. They're starting another lefty. The lefties are killing us. Get some hits, and let's see what happens. So grabbed a bat boy, borrowed a glove, had him throw me all kinds of balls in the dirt. So I got the first inning home against the Reds. And first ball's in the hole, Billy Russell throws. It's high, and I jump up and catch it and kind of go with it and tag the runner on the head. And probably goes out. My Lord, my first play. Third inning, Davey Lopes throws one in the dirt, and I pick it out of the dirt. It's too hard. Right? We should ask Jock Peterson that right now, but I was down there anyway, you know. Got a couple of hits, drove in 2 runs, and we won the game. And I'm sitting there after the game and feeling good about the day. You know, where you work hard and everything comes together, or something comes out of nowhere, and it happens, and it's blessed for you. And I'm there, and all of a sudden, Alston comes up the tunnel, walks by, doesn't stop, and I hear, you're in there tomorrow. And I look at Steve Yeager, and I said, Yeager, he's talking to you or me. He says, Garber, I think it's you. He said, I'm in there tomorrow. I said, okay. And the next day, I got a few more hits, but that Saturday evening began say, Russell, Lopes, and Garvey, and began my career. And I always say, if I didn't say, oh, yeah, I could play, oh, I played first, I probably wouldn't be with you today. But that I did, I took a chance, carpe diem, you seize the moment. If the boss says, can you do it? Absolutely. You know, you can't do this. Yes, I can. And all of a sudden, you find your destiny. And ended up being a 5'10 first baseman. You know, not a lot of 5'10 first basemen. Rose started to play there, and, you know, you didn't have to be big and power hitter who couldn't field. And digging the balls out of the dirt was one of my true skills. We used to throw the ball around between innings, and Russell would yell at me, Garb, get off your knees. I'm saving your throws, and you're telling me to get off my knees, and then he'd smile at me, you know. But you never know in the course of life when opportunity may arise, and just take a chance. I did.
Can you talk a little about the cultural moment when, around the time that you won the Most Valuable Player Award in 1974, on the one hand, there were sort of countercultural guys who were a little bit of a outside of the traditional mold of baseball players, and then there were the more wholesome, the Gary Carters and you and people like that. As one article said, you were a guy who did not swear, chew tobacco, or wear jeans.
And I still don't.
Can you describe a little about what about how you sort of got caught up in that?
Well, I grew up in the South, you know, and again, I was an only child, so I had two mentors, two parents. It was me, good cop, bad cop, you know, they had tag team. You know, I grew up in the conservative South, and, you know, that's when they said, oh, you know, your son dresses, you know, conservatively. I wore Gantt shirts and alpaca sweaters and had my initials on them, and I spent my money on my clothes. But back then, it was God, football, and Bear Bryant. Right, and there was a way that you growing up as an athlete and in the Deep South, the way you comported yourself and the way you acted, and it wasn't cussing and it wasn't disrespecting, and it was dressing appropriately, and you dressed up for church, and all those things became who I am. I always say, and as a parent, and we talk about the diversity of our children, but one thing is a constant: is when we're born, we bring nothing onto this earth. I mean, God's given us certain inherent skills that will come to the forefront. But everything is learned. So I was in a culture, environment, family that I was taught a certain way, and I've been that way all my life and taught our children. All the girls have gone left on me. They go to college. They've gone left. And I'm a guy who used to introduce President Reagan, you know, through the years. I'm a reasonable conservative, as they say. But again, all those things add up, and they end up being who you are, being true to yourself, and you take nothing. We take nothing with us when we die, by the way. So we told the kids it's not going to be much in the will. So go out and work hard. It's a small will. We didn't make much back then.
Many articles were written saying there was a tension between you and some of your teammates about the way that you were perceived. And you certainly were becoming more of a celebrity. You were appearing on the Mike Douglas Show. You were on an episode of Fantasy Island. And certainly...
Deplane, boss, deplane.
To what degree are those stories true? Was there a tension between you and your Dodgers teammates at that time?
Well, I think anytime you live and work with a group of people closely, day in and day out for a period of time, and that basically 8 months, you're always going to have disagreements. We're talking about Steve Garvey from Tampa, Florida, and Billy Russell from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, and Ron Say from Tacoma, Washington, Davey Lopes from Providence, Rhode Island, and guys from all over the country. You're gonna have different backgrounds, different cultures, but the common denominator is, you know, respect for each other on and off the field. And you're on a team, you've got to work together, you've got to play together, you've got to learn how to play the game. You've got to take all of your time in a relatively short career. And I spoke to the Dodgers in spring training about the blink of an eye. And how many of you guys, and I remember Utley was there, this was two springs ago, and he was looking at me, he was smiling, because he was at the end of the blink of an eye. And don't take things for granted, work hard. Don't accept defeat. Keep trying to make yourself better. Don't let them take the game away from you. And it's going to happen. But go out there and make yourself so valuable that they've got to take you or somebody else has to. And I think that's the one thing I learned. We had disagreements, but most of the time, invariably, we just talked them out because we were going to have to go out on that field and represent the Dodgers and baseball and our fans. So you had to put that to the side and go out and do your job.
You had a great deal of postseason success, and let's say in 81, it wasn't your best year statistically, but you performed in the postseason. 84, not your best year statistically, performed in the postseason. What was the ability, what did you have that allowed you to perform under pressure the way that you did?
Well, those were two interesting years. 81, I think you all may remember that it was the strike-shortened year, and it was a very odd year. They split up the two seasons. Cincinnati was mad as heck because they could have easily won, you know, both of them. But it was a year where I think we only played 104 games, around 10. So what happened was, I mean, you know, all of a sudden seasons, you know, you look at the, why do you have bad numbers here? Well, it was only 110 games. But then 84 was the year I was coming off a broken thumb where I had torn the ligament that ended the consecutive game streak here. So my hand, I think all injuries take a year to symmetrically come back. So I didn't have the strength in my bottom hand, but still was able to do the things expected of. Not as many home runs, but RBIs and runs, et cetera. So those 2 years, along with my philosophy of, and I know what you're getting to, and I appreciate that. The more critical the situation, the more important the situation, I wanted to be up at the plate. I wanted the ball hit to me. And if I failed, I failed daringly. Just like I can play first base. But if you don't want to be in that situation, if you have a fear of failure, you don't want the ball to hit to you, you don't want to face Nolan Ryan, Steve Carlton, then you're probably going to fail because you're going to be tentative, you're going to step back, you're not going to be aggressive. You know, no matter what people say, people always say, well, you know, pitchers control the game. But when you're standing on that mound, and by the way, hitters are on defense. Too many people talk about that, but we're trying to prevent that ball from getting to the catcher's glove. And if you look hitterish, if you look like you're ready to hit, that pitcher's going to say, uh-oh, you know, I better be a little more careful. They'll leave a ball over the plate. They lose control. You get a 3-0 count. And you're playing as a hitter, playing that pitcher to ultimately get that one, maybe two pitches that you can drive in the situation where not a lot of people want to be in.
Down to our last 15 minutes or so, I've been handed a series
it flies of here.
Questions. It does. Why did you bunt to break up Bob Ochinko's no-hitter in the 1977 season?
Is Bob's mother here? Is she here? Mrs. Ochinko, are you here? Let's be perfectly honest. The burden is always on the defense. And when you're losing and that other fellow's throwing a perfect game at the time, your role is to get on base any way that you possibly can. You can stand on top of the plate and hope to get hit. You can stand up there and try to hit the ball and miss those eight guys that are in front of you. Or you can drop down a bunt. And the irony is the catcher, because I'd get 10 or 12 bunt hits a year. I probably bunted more than any guy that had power that I know. Maybe Mickey Mantle bunted more. So he yells to the third baseman, hey, watch it now, you know, like this. Third baseman comes in even with a bag. And so you got to bunt on the first pitch because that, you know, you don't want to go deeper in the count. You wanted the element of surprise. So I figured, heck with you guys. First pitch was a fastball, dropped it down. Beat it out at first base. And the boos were deafening, as you can imagine. But we ended up winning. We ended up scoring two runs, ended up winning by two runs. And I don't have a lot of remorse because we won. I do feel bad that, you know, no hitters and perfect games are those magical times in a pitcher's career. But we don't get paid to have sympathy for the other guys. We get paid to win games.
Who was the toughest pitcher you ever faced?
That's a great question. I think I faced, maybe some of you guys would know, you guys have all the stats here, 12, 14 Hall of Famers. And as always, when I speak in lecture, baseball questions, this is the top three. And I always say Phil Niekro was the one guy I just didn't really care to face because I was a guesstimator. I would watch pitchers and arm angles and delivery box, and I'd watch catchers, and catchers have sequences that they like. And but with Phil Niekro, he didn't know where he was going, the catcher didn't know where he was going, and you're supposed to hit it. So, and by the way, they're the only type of pitcher that likes the wind blowing out, right? Because it affects a ball that's not moving. Humidity, love humidity. Atlanta, he had tremendous success. So he was the toughest. I'd get on top of the plate, spread out, and I was a contact hitter, and just think, hit the other way, and wait, and wait, and wait.
Please talk about the Bobby Dolan dinner in Reno. What did it mean to you to speak there?
Well, you know, I am also blessed to speak at several sports-themed dinners over the years, and that is one of the greatest ones in the country. Historically, they have a number of excellent people that come and speak, athletes, but it's the spirit of that dinner. Whose question is this? Yeah, it's the spirit of that dinner, I think, more than anything else. It's a privilege to come there, the history of it, and have me back again sometime, okay? I got to get out of the desert. I live in Indian Wells, and it's 109 today, so when the dinner, it's a little cooler back then.
Was it true that you were ejected by an umpire for simply saying, bear down?
Was I ejected? I can't remember. Yeah. Well, I never believed in, and I had great rapport with the umpires because I always felt they had a tougher job than us. They're never home. They travel on the road every place they go. Unless you live in a town, then you only get 6 or 8 days a year. You actually get to sleep in your own bed. But it was bases loaded. It was against Atlanta. I was on deck, nobody out. Ball was hit back to the pitcher. He throws home. Catcher tags the plate, throws to first, double play. And Bip Roberts, who was pretty quick, our second baseman, had rounded. I saw him round third, and he was coming home. And I got in a position, I gave him the slide sign, and he went in head first. And I saw his hand go over the plate and the catcher tag him clearly, you know, afterwards. And the umpire, I think it was Charlie Williams, was a little bit up the first baseline, and he called him out. And he said, Charlie, he said, he missed home plate. Now, if he would have said he tagged him, it's really nothing I could have said. But he said he missed home plate, and I went over, and there's a hand in the dirt going over home plate. So in one of my rare moments of being kind of a wise guy, I had my bat, and I took a circle, and I said, Charlie, look, right here. Well, that was the wrong decision, wrong thing to do on my part. Usually, the umpires feel like you're showing them up, even if they were wrong. And I said, but then still, I think I probably had a chance, and I went, Charlie, I said, you got to bear down. And Steve Boris had come out, our manager, and he was yelling, and I hear, you're out of here. And I go to first base, and they had put my, I think Gary Temple had put my glove in ball, and I picked it up, and I started throwing the ball around. And Harry Wendelstad, I saw him kind of come up to me, and he said, Steve, I said, yeah, Harry, you're out of the game. I said, what? He said, you're out of the game. Why? He said, he threw you out. He what? And I said, I didn't cuss him. He says, I know you, but you must have said something. And I looked at Charlie, who was home plate like this, looking at me, you know, as authority does look at. So in my second act, rare act of being a wise guy again, I took the ball and they put it on first base, and I slowly walked to the dugout, kind of looking at him. Didn't say anything. I mean, didn't, you know, nothing. And then the fans started to boo. And I think that was, you know, one of those rare times when I felt bad. Probably should have just ran in. Probably shouldn't have said anything. Yep. Did he touch home plate? Yes. But, you know, you got to respect the umpires at all times.
What do you remember about your final college game, 1968, when Michigan State played a doubleheader on the final day of the season to decide the Big Ten title?
Well, in the Big Ten, a lot of the fields aren't as sophisticated as they are now. Michigan State's got a wonderful new field. It's the only field in college baseball now that's heated, the infield, grass. That's pretty great. New technology. But if we were to win both games at Minnesota, we would win the Big Ten. And we won the first game. Second game was really close. They had us by 2 runs. Bases loaded, one out, and I come up to the plate. And again, there's snow fences in most of these Midwest con. And I hit a line shot, and the outfielder was playing me about 3 feet in front of the snow fence. And he reached up and caught the ball and put his hand on the fence, and it bent back. And he threw the ball in and held everybody. And the next guy popped out. But that's, you know, if I was smarter, I would have had a better launch angle, right?
Do you feel that sabermetrics have affected your Hall of Fame candidacy?
Well, obviously, if you don't watch the game and have played the game and understand the game at the level of a player who's considered for the Hall of Fame, I think there have to be more variables. And believe me, I believe in the quality of metrics. But say, for instance, at first base. I mean, they didn't measure balls being dug out of the dirt. So I used to dig 4, 5, 6 balls out of the dirt a week and say 2 runs score a week. I saved 2 runs. And you measure that over 4 weeks of a month, 6 months to the regular season, and you can see, 48 runs saved by being able to dig the ball out of the dirt, and that's one of the big reasons I won Gold Glove. So if you don't factor that in, you're probably not factoring in a talent I had that separated from most people. I mean, not too many other guys could dig the balls out like I did at first base. Who are you going to put in to replace me to do that, to save those number of runs? So some of the statistics that I did, well, I led the league at least once or twice in ground out RBIs. What'd that mean? Well, it means that I sacrificed myself to get the run in from third with less than 2 outs. How do you factor playing every day for 7.5 years relative to the team's success, the number of World Series we went to, and the influence I had on the number of wins that we had? I mean, it'd be a good statistic to find out how many games were I involved in that we won over my time, say, from 73 to, say, 84. I mean, do you factor a player's winning percentage in? So if you don't, if you just go by 300 average, you go by 3,000 hits, 500 home runs, then you're going on traditional Hall of Fame numbers. But my career, I think, is a body of work that you, if you don't factor in the consecutive game streak and errorless season and 191 consecutive games, the ability to save runs defensively. I think a lot of times, you know, voters go on the offensive ability of a player. And there's only been a few over the years, I think Mazeroski, and although they hit the ball, Ozzie and so forth, where defense was the primary reason. So, you know, maybe this year, maybe the ballot this time. It's an interesting dichotomy now of 16 voters that are general managers and former players and so forth. And maybe, you know, it's one of those things where I don't lose sleep over it. I do wish, though, that the voters would do a comprehensive look at my whole career. And we'll see.
I'm in
the Irish Baseball Hall of Fame. I'm in California Hall of Fame, Florida Hall of Fame, Michigan State Hall of Fame. So Cooperstown has a nice meaning to it.
Kurt Bavakwa told us that he was your shadow in 1984 and that you never, underlined, got your uniform dirty. Comment on that, please.
Well, you know, when I first went to spring training, that first day of spring training, there was a lot of press, you know. And Garvey going from, you know, out of the blue was a great poster, by the way, that they did here. And Kurt was the original photo bomber. He was in every piece of video, every still shot, And then they would say, well, you must know Gar pretty well. Oh, we're roomies. We're roomies? What do you mean we're roomies? So we actually had a lot of fun with it. And I think that was one of the reasons why we built a pretty neat camaraderie that year in 83 and then 84, 85. And then, you know, after 3 years, a lot of times teams start to differentiate and go on. But that was the fun we had with each other. And I see him from time to time. And he never picked up a check, by the way. He says, Garv, you got the big contract. You can afford it. You know? I said, okay. You better get a pinch hit. Then one night he got up to pinch hit, bases loaded, went out in the ninth, hit back to the pitcher, home to first, ended the game. Oh, he went crazy. Next night, bases loaded, one out, bottom of the ninth, right back to the pitcher again, home to first, ended the game. I said, I'm not buying for you the rest of the next homestand. And he got a pinch hit double the next night, so food talks.
Our final question is also about Kurt Pavakwa. It says, Kurt Pavakwa told some stories about you on Thursday. It's only fair you get to tell one more about him.
Well, I mean, he was called Dirty Kurt. Do I have to tell another story about like that? Is he here today? Is he lurking somewhere? No? I'll tell you, though, you know, you talk about finding your role in your profession and baseball. You know, he was a very good athlete. He and Jay Johnstone, by the way, of the Dodgers, became really good 10th man, really good pinch hitters, could play various positions, more of hybrid guys before hybrid came along. But they carved out a niche and probably got 5, 6, 7 years more out of their career than a normal guy who said, no, I can only do this, I can only do that. I'm not pinch hitting, you know, I'm an everyday type of player, and would fight it, and all of a sudden he's retired, and then he looks back and says, boy, I should have said, yeah, I can do that, right? But Kurt was the kind of guy that got the most out of his career by finding what the team needed and working till he became the guy they needed. And I think that's so very, very important. And Jay Johnstone was the same way. Quickly, though, two of them both had the same thing in common, a great sense of humor, which kept the clubhouse really kept the clubhouse light. But Jerry Royce and Jay Johnstone, in the middle of a seventh inning in about 81, and Jerry was starting pitcher, so he wasn't working that night. I'm sitting there, and it's the middle of the fifth inning, and I'm watching the ground crew come out to drag the infield. And I'm looking, and I see this tall guy I'd never seen before with kind of blonde hair coming out of his hat. Well, Johnstone and Royce had gotten the grounds crew uniforms on and were dragging the infield. Two guys could be in the game, were dragging the infield, and they started to get towards first base, and the ground crew would bring up their screens and walk up and go out. And I said to Lasorda, those two last guys look familiar to him? He goes, is that Joyce? Is that Johnstone? I'm finding those guys. I'm going to find those guys. And he starts to go off, and you know, about 10 minutes later, Royce comes in with his uniform on. I saw you out there. Me? Yeah. Where's Johnstone? Oh, he's down in the bullpen. Yeah, he better get down here right now. So it's the bottom of the eighth, the game's tied, and Johnstone's sitting there, and he said, you better get a hit. Johnstone hits a home run, and we win. And Lasorda says, you're still fined $3,000. So the next day, Rick Dees, remember the great radio personality in Los Angeles, Rick Dees, infamous. He hears about it. He calls me, and we do a radiothon, and end up raising $8,000 for the two guys. It all went to charity, by the way. But those are the things that happen, and sometimes you're pushing the envelope, but that's what keeps teams loose and cohesive.
Our time for the hour is up, and so we wanted to thank Steve Garvey very much for coming today.
Thank you.